You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, December 14th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, the former president's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, gets a criminal contempt referral to the DOJ. Meanwhile, the January 6th committee hearings blow up. Kentucky tornado death toll now at 88 and climbing. California reinstitutes indoor mask mandates. And the Supreme Court lets the New York State vaccine mandate for healthcare workers stand. Also on the program today, Biden administration now admits it was not legally compelled to issue massive oil and gas drilling leases. New Omicron study coming out of South Africa has much more resistance to two shots of Pfizer. Protection down to 30 some odd percent, according to this study. 70% protection against hospitalization with two shots of Pfizer. Israel complains it needs U.S. airborne refueling tankers to threaten an attack on Iran. The internal battle at the FDIC breaks open and tells a story of this administration. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. A little flying by the seats of our pants. I sort of always do that anyways. But you will notice Emma Vigeland not with us today. She was here until she got word that her friend just tested positive for COVID. So she ran out of the office and is getting a rapid test at the moment. That's part of it.
Her friend said, quote, feels like COVID, which is a bad
not a good sign. Yeah. Not a good sign. I don't even know what that means. No. I haven't gotten COVID, but you don't want. I mean, I just feel, you know, this is just flying around. And you've been boosted, right?
I am about to get boosted, but ooh, not yet boosted.
So Matt's a little bit little unboosted.
I was actually worried I had COVID. That's why I didn't get boosted this week. And I got tested. It's negative. So
Thanks for telling me. I've been boosted. I'm in fortress.
I should get the Moderna booster, shouldn't I?
Yep.
Yeah.
Why not mix and match?
Exactly.
If I had the opportunity to do it again, I would get that. Maybe I'll just go in and get a booster anyways. I'm on a vaccine jag. I'll get it with my my second shot of the shingles vaccine. I'll get another flu shot. I don't care. What else can I get? I'll take it. I'm a pincushion as far as I'm concerned these days. We will get to all of that stuff. Also, would you do me a favor, Matt, when you get a chance? We may have a new segment today. Our crackers and cheese segment that we may be introducing. You'll see the bag of crackers we got over there. Unfortunately, we couldn't get the cheese. Yeah, that's it. I just want to just buy the ready just in case we need it. We may have, some crackers and cheese today. We'll see. We're going to get to, some of this big story. Sadly, it involves playing Lynn Cheney without, actively, criticizing her. Anytime that we ever mention Lynn Cheney or we play anything that involves Lynn Cheney, please be aware that the critique is understood. Liz Cheney, whatever. I don't care. Either Cheney, any Cheney. But let's play this first. Fox News. Are they covering the fact that multiple members of their on-camera staff were texting the White House during the January 6th riots in the Capitol? Please, please tell the president to tell people to stop. Please, please. Are they reporting that? No. They are still very, very concerned about the plot surrounding their $500,000 Christmas tree that was lit on fire. They're going to get to the bottom of this. Incidentally, the guy's been caught, and apparently he's just a guy who has some mental and emotional issues. Frankly,
has he been executed yet, though?
Well, we'll see. Frankly, I mean, I don't know how many mental and emotional issues you have to want to light a $500,000 tree on fire. Like, I would be in favor of maybe pushing it over. But let's, here is Peter Ducey, Steve's son, no nepotism there, at the White House press pool asking the really important questions.
The big cities are dealing with these smash and grab robberies right now, increase in criminal activity, because some prosecutors are too soft on crime.
I would say we have seen, I'm not going to attribute the reasoning from here. What I will tell you is we have seen an increase in crime over the course of the pandemic. There are a range of reasons for that. And what our focus is on is what we can do to address it. The president has proposed additional funding in the budget to make sure local police departments and cops have the funding they need. We have also worked directly with police departments in areas where they are seeing the highest impact of the crime, the retail theft, which we have great concern about. That's what our focus is on currently, is action and doing what we can to make sure the funding is out there to the communities that need it the most.
But I guess, what good does it do if you're going to give police departments extra money if they arrest bad guys and they bring them to jail, and then they're not prosecuted? They're just right back out on the streets.
I think, Peter, what our focus is on is making sure that the local leaders, the police officers and departments who know what they need for these communities, have the assistance and the funding they need. And that's what we're working around the clock on.
So the final one would be, just in the last week, we saw a New York Post item about a pickpocket with more than 30 arrests back out on the street. We've seen an arsonist burn down a $500,000 Christmas tree in New York City back out on the streets. Does the president think that's good governing?
Again, I think I've spoken to the president's concerns about retail theft. If you have specific and the actions we've taken for specific cases, I would point you to the local police departments or the Department of Justice. Go ahead, Kelly.
Is it possible that Steve Ducey or Peter Ducey is not aware that these prosecutors have no association with the federal government whatsoever? I mean, even if the premise was correct, which it's not, the lighting of the Fox Christmas tree is not a sign that there is more crime in the country. The fact of the matter is, there is not more crime in the country.
Yeah.
There are some high-profile thefts that were in San Francisco
that get a lot of play in media.
Yeah, of course, because they're on video, and it looks like a huge heist.
It's like Ocean's 12, but with like Clorox and maybe some watches.
Exactly. But this is sort of like, you know, this is akin to the war on Christmas. This is, I mean, frankly, this is, it's very well done. If you were to listen to the narrative that has been created in the news, you would think that inflation is crushing people. But also the reason why inflation is crushing people is because of the child tax credit. That's what Joe Manchin is saying. The reason why we have inflation is because people have more money. And therefore, they're being crushed, even though they have more money. You would also believe that there are tens of thousands of people leaving their works because of the vaccine mandate. We have no military. I saw a headline today that 27 people in our Air Force, have been dismissed because they won't get vaccinated. 27. Not 2,700, not 27,000, 27. And the other one would be that we're having this massive crime spree, as indicated by the fact that Fox News' Christmas tree got lit on fire.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say, like, with regards to the violent crime during a pandemic, that's not uncharacteristic of pandemics. Early in the pandemic, I read Daniel Defoe's Journal of the Plague Year. It's like 1700s or whatever. And they had a problem because they had to keep replacing the guards that were making sure people were staying in homes because people kept killing them. Right?
We're not quite at that level. But yeah, there's a certain inevitable when you're having basically parts of society somewhat break down because of a pandemic.
And support doesn't go to the people who need it the most. First thing I heard, like, the day that the checks were going out is I ain't file taxes. I'm not going to get any of that stuff. So, like, huge parts of the economy aren't formal in that way, and they're left out. So, like, yep. Of course there's going to be a rise in these sorts of crimes of like, deprivation and, you know, serious pressure.
We're going to take a break. Going to talk about some sponsors that we have on the show, and then we're going to get into some of the stuff that's coming out about January 6th. If you own a business, you know that there's not enough hours in the day to waste time playing phone tag. Well, the list of customers that you need to reach doesn't get any shorter, especially when business is good. That's why local businesses everywhere turn to Podium. Podium makes every interaction as easy as sending a text. So everything that makes your business great can get done faster. I think the Mac place that we use uses that. And it's been incredibly helpful. It's really the only, except for the fact that we couldn't get the routers in for like 8 months because of the supply lines or whatnot. It makes everything that we get, every contact that we have with them easier. And Podium isn't just a better way to communicate. It's a better way to do everything. Gathering reviews, collecting payments, and even marketing to your customers, Podium makes it all as easy as pressing send. You won't just free up more time. You'll grow your business and get more done. With Podium, you close deals with customers before the competition even has a chance to call them back. Like I say, I haven't used it as a business. We don't. That's not what we do. But as a customer, I appreciate getting some type of response time. Not even going to tell you what happened to me with, God, what was it the other day that I had that was driving me crazy? I can't remember. I was on the phone for an hour and a half. Oh, with my bank. They locked me out of my, but it's not a totally different story. Join more than 100,000 businesses that already use Podium to streamline their customer interactions. Get started for free at podium.com/majority or sign up for a paid Podium account and get a free credit card reader. Restrictions apply. That's podium.com/majority. If you own a small business, local business, check it out. Meanwhile, also, if you own a business, you know scaling your business is a journey of endless possibility. Well, Shopify is here to help. It's got tools and resources that make it easy for any business to succeed down the street to around the globe. Shopify powers over 1.7 million businesses from first sale to full scale. Shopify gives entrepreneurs the resources once reserved for big business, so upstarts, startups, and established businesses alike can sell everywhere, synchronize online and in-person sales, and effortlessly stay informed. With Shopify, you can reach customers online and across social networks with an ever-growing suite of channel integrations and apps. It includes Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Pinterest, more. Synchronize your online and in-person sales and gain insights as you grow with detailed reporting, More than a store, Shopify grows with you. This is possibility, and it is powered by Shopify. If you go to shop.majorityreportradio.com, you can see an example of just one of the most basic uses of Shopify. That's where we sell our merch, and it's been super easy. And as you grow, and if you sell offline and online, as a lot of places do, that gets integrated with Shopify, you should check it out. Go to shopify.com/majority, all lowercase, for a free 14-day trial and get full access to Shopify's entire suite of features. Grow your business with Shopify today. Go to shopify.com/majority right now. Shopify.com/majority. Lastly, winter is just about here. Many places of the country it is already. And the outdoors is calling. And if you want to answer, backcountry.com is the place to go. When you shop at backcountry.com, you can pick up the phone and talk gear with an actual former Olympian. It's founded by former Olympic skier. Backcountry.com is the best place for outdoor gear and apparel. They got Patagonia. They got Yeti. Santa Cruz bicycles. They got everything there. It's sort of insane. Kuehl coats. Am I pronouncing that right? Kuehl? That's the one I have. Has thousands of your favorite brands and products for every outdoor adventure. When you ask for help at backcountry.com, you're not getting an outdoor hobbyist. Backcountry gearheads are experts, and they give you a masterclass in the great outdoors. From providing you a detailed pack list for your next summit to figuring out what winter jacket works for you, you're in good hands. Everything at Backcountry, everything it sells is the highest quality. But the Backcountry gearheads are the real difference. And I will tell you this. Last year, I got snowboards. Didn't want to deal with the rental. We don't go anywhere special, really, for snowboarding. Just the local, like, they're not hills, but they're mountains, sort of, around here. You know, hill, mountain. But I didn't want to rent for the kids. Mila's basically locked in, so I bought her a board and boots. Saul, I bought a board because I can change the, and, you know, when you buy a snowboard, you got to buy the snowboard, you got to buy the bindings. And I will tell you who knows nothing about that stuff, me. They walked me through both purchases, and it was a breeze, and it worked out perfectly for the kids. That was a huge, huge help. We got boards, we got boots, and we got bindings. Go to backcountry.com/majority, enter promo code majority, and you'll get 15% off your first full price purchase. Some exclusions apply, so go right now. Get 15% off at backcountry.com/majority and enter promo code majority. Backcountry.com/majority. Don't forget to enter promo code majority. All right, let's get into some of this stuff with the January 6th committee. There was a story that came out that Hunter Walker has been writing these stories in Rolling Stone about this couple that was involved. They're basically MAGA heads. They were involved with the Stop the Steal bus tour. And that's the story we had talked about a couple of weeks ago, where they met with Representative Gozar, who said, you know, blanket pardons could be available. And it turns out what he was talking about was that this couple was involved with Steve Bannon in their build a wall scam. And for some reason, they were not rolled up when the other people were. But they were worried about their criminal liability. So the idea of a pardon was pretty intriguing to them. It's unclear exactly like what information they're going to provide, other than the fact that they had been hearing about violence that was being planned for that day on January 6th, and they warned Mark Meadows about it. I mean, it's becoming increasingly clear that there were people who knew that there was something else going on, sort of embedded within this stuff. And a lot of people were sort of duped on some level. This couple claims that they thought, they were led to believe, or they assumed that Trump had access to special information about the stealing of the election.
Yeah, I'm the president. I got the best information.
I control the deep state. And it turns out, like, they thought at this rally he was going to unveil this information. And when he didn't, they were like, what is going on? And when instead, he ended the rally by saying, like, literally the last words that he said was like, go to the Capitol now.
A lot of ways, I meant that poetically, though.
Now, this couple apparently went back to their hotel because they're like, we're getting out of here. Something's gone very wrong. And they have since been on, essentially, on the lam. Because they're afraid that right-wingers are coming after them. It's, you know, there's a certain amount of paranoia that goes with this crew of people anyway, so it's hard to tell what their concerns are. But yesterday and today, Liz Cheney, apparently, because she's one of two Republicans on the committee, was charged with reading off some of these text messages that they got from Mark Meadows that came from Fox News hosts. And it's clear a lot of these people were like, wait a sec. I mean, first off, it's also amazing that these people
took this long.
They're so integrated. Well, I mean... Well, a couple things. One, Mark Meadows is an idiot. You don't give the committee all of the relevant documents you have and then go like, but wait a second, I'm now not going to testify. What happened is Meadows is such a moron that he thought that Trump would appreciate the way that he wrote about him in the book. Because in Meadows' mind, saying that Trump was ill during going around would made him seem like an ubermensch.
It was like the Michael Jordan flu game in Utah.
Exactly. Meadows was like, dude, this is a brag. You had COVID and went around and just like...
And I still crushed it.
I still crushed it. But then apparently Trump was like, no, you're not supposed to tell anybody that I had COVID. I was trying to infect people. And so then, essentially, I guess Trump basically said, you better not testify now in front of that committee, you idiot. And Meadows was like, oh, okay. I already gave them all my documentation, though. So now, all this stuff gets rolled out. And Meadows, of course, is not there to testify. He was trying to avoid a criminal contempt charge that would be voted upon by all of his former colleagues in the House. Apparently, maintaining good relationships with them was pretty important to this dunce. And instead, what he did was give everything to the committee and then get a criminal contempt referral. Now, the implications of this for the criminal contempt thing are virtually nil, as far as I can tell. Even Bannon is not going to court until July. Presumably, Meadows would go to court after that. The Democrats are probably going to lose the House anyways in 2022, although it's not for sure. And also, they may look upon Meadows in a different way than they did Bannon. Meadows was the chief of staff. If there's anybody who could claim executive privilege, it would be Meadows as opposed to Bannon. But we'll see. In the meantime, we have these little gems from the Trump media shop, sometimes referred to in public as Fox News. Here is Liz Cheney, the despicable one, reading materials from former Trump chief of staff Mark Meadows. This is stuff that he provided to the committee before he decided I wasn't going to cooperate. And here are some of the frantic texts that come from the Fox News host, because they're thinking like, God, there's going to be so hard on us to try and pretend like this didn't happen. Remember, Laura Ingraham, hours after she sends this text, is claiming that these people are Antifa. Remember? Here it is.
Help us. Dozens of texts, including from Trump administration officials, urged immediate action by the president. Quote, POTUS has to come out firmly and tell the protesters to dissipate. Someone is going to get killed. In another, Mark, he needs to stop this now. A third, in all caps, tell them to go home. A fourth, and I quote, POTUS needs to calm this shit down. Indeed, according to the records, multiple Fox News hosts knew the president needed to act immediately. They texted Mr. Meadows, and he has turned over those texts. Quote, Mark, the president needs to tell people in the Capitol to go home. This is hurting all of us. He is destroying his legacy, Laura Ingraham wrote. Please get him on TV.
How is that
destroying?
Destroy your legacy when it's all Antifa.
Yeah, that's weird. And why would Antifa even listen to him?
Why would all of these secret Antifa people listen to Trump?
Laura, it's Antifa. If I tell them to stop, they're just going to do more.
Be worse. This is what they want. Me to say stop so they can say no.
I'm trying to do reverse psychology. That's why I told them to go to the Capitol.
Because I thought they would all go back to, like, storm Nancy Pelosi's office. Wait, no, they did. Oop. Go ahead.
Turned over those texts. Quote, Mark, the president needs to tell people in the Capitol to go home. This is hurting all of us. He is destroying his legacy, Laura Ingraham wrote.
Dear Laura,
please get him on TV, destroying everything you have accomplished, Brian Kilmeade texted. Quote, can he make a statement? Ask people to leave the Capitol, Sean Hannity urged. As the violence continued, one of the president's sons texted Mr. Meadows, quote, he's got to condemn this shit ASAP. The Capitol Police tweet is not enough, Donald Trump Jr. texted. Meadows responded, quote, I'm pushing it hard. I agree. Still, President Trump did not immediately act. Donald Trump Jr. texted again and again, urging action by the president. Quote, we need an Oval Office address. He has to lead now. It has gone too far and gotten out of hand, end quote. But hours passed without necessary action by the president.
Looks like Donald Trump Jr. Had a lot invested in this.
That angle is very interesting to me.
Yeah.
First of all, when Donald Trump
I'm revoking Jr., your first name.
Yeah, look, who are you again?
You're so weak.
Yeah, no. I'm going to watch how it goes. But if Donald Trump Jr. is your voice of reason as a country, you're in
big trouble.
Pretty big trouble.
This is like a it's like Succession, isn't it?
I think it's that and like how this took so to this moment for anybody to say anything. Like when I hear that, I think that nobody stepped in until it had become a crisis already. And everyone knew Jan 6 was what was leading up to this. That somebody should have stepped in on January 2nd and had been doing something. Like all these guys doing something in the moment, like it's not that impressive to me.
Well, what's also interesting to me is, and we don't know, they haven't. I don't know that they've revealed everybody who was IMing Meadows at that moment, but. It would be interesting. I suspect that there are multiple different routes to Trump. And one is through Mark Meadows, And that is where you see, like, the media people going through and the Sun. Like the media, but I wonder how Bannon or Roger Stone or that crew got in touch with Trump.
That, maybe that's like the Flynn, Charlie Flynn stuff.
I mean, there's just no way that everybody's funneled through Mark Meadows. This guy's a dunce. There's people going around him. It's not like Kushner and, you know, where is... Does anybody remember Ivanka?
Oh, right.
Forgot about her.
Like, she, her press people, Ivanka's press people have done a very, very good job in making her disappear. Like, to the point where it's like, she's going to show up and she's going to be calling herself Ivanka Kushner soon. And then they're just going to both refer to themselves as like his middle name or his mom's, you know, maiden name. But that's pretty stunning. It shows you the panic that is associated with these media people whose job it is to carry water for these people.
I'm not going to be able to spin this, basically.
All right, we'll get back to this, but at the moment, we're going to do our special new, we have a new segment on this program. We don't have any special music for it, sadly, but why don't we just, it's this, it's our cracker and cheese segment. Huh? You got them? And our first guest on our new crackers and cheese segment is Hassan Piker. Hello, Hassan. Welcome. Congratulations.
What's going on? I just wanted to say hello from a fellow cracker. From a cracker to another.
We don't have any cheese today, but this is because we didn't do it. But so we do have the crackers. So, dude, you got banned from Twitch.
I sure did. I got a fat 7-day ban from Twitch for my usage of the horrific, racially charged, incendiary, and absolutely unacceptable term, cracker.
I think we're getting your computer audio, not your microphone.
Oh, hold on. Let me change it up real quick. Wow. See, I get banned and I forget how to...
Incidentally, today is Crunch Master Multi Seed, the original. We don't get any type of promotional support from this at all.
You're doing it for this because you got skin in the game. You just love the crackers. Wait, how does this sound now? Does it sound good?
That sounds great. Now listen, I am of the mind that terms of service are the business of these private companies. But there seems to me to be a difference between the N word and the C word as
are we doing that? We're just going to say the C word.
I mean, we don't know which C word we're talking about because there's other words to say with the C word. And the reason why we don't know really is because there is not a long history of the use of the term crackers that has been associated with subjugating an entire segment of the population, right? Like, words have a meaning that is invested in them by experience. Words in and of themselves mean nothing. It really is like, you know, some type of a established history. But what's your take on that?
Well, I have a lot of takes on that. I mean, as a matter of fact, part of the reason why I did get banned is because I would not stop with my takes on this issue. But I'll just say this. If you say the C word and there's like 8 other words that come to mind before cracker, then I'm pretty sure even if it's a part of the, you know, Webster's dictionary definition of slurs that target a race, it's probably not, you know, bad enough that it's ban-worthy, which was my point to begin with, because I think that it's capitulating to white fragility and white identity politics, which goes against solidarity and, you know, solidarity among classes. And I think that it's totally silly. And all of the people that freaked out on me on Reddit and on Twitter are now doing touchdown dances and also making fun of how, like, you know, silly this was. Like, oh man, I'm so glad we banned him for, you know, we got him banned for saying the C word. It's just classic old Gamergate era 4chan style, you know, politics from edgelords.
All right. So, I mean, give me your sense, like, in terms of a term of service. Do you think, like, the, you know, the N word should be allowed by Twitch or YouTube? I mean,
no, of course not. No, of course not. I believe that if a word is not associated with historical or contemporary systemic oppression and subjugation, then it's just a slur that isn't as powerful and therefore is not the same. Like, you can apply the blanket terminology of what a slur is, right, to it. And slur is a very powerful word in and of itself. So immediately when you're like, well, that's a slur, that's a racial slur, you're like, whoa, what the fuck? That's crazy. Technically, it is. But given the loose definition of what white is, given the etymology of the word cracker itself, and just like you mentioned, how it's devoid of any sort of, like, tangible and legitimate oppression, both historically and even in contemporary society, it's the same as redneck, hillbilly, Karen, and numerous other kinds of, you know, targeted slurs, I guess, pejoratives.
I mean, this is sort of, you know, what my point is when I got fired from, MSNBC for using the term rape in a satirical tweet that I did years before. And people were like, you know, there was, and I felt like, no, I mean, MSNBC has the right to fire me if they want to fire me. I mean, it's their company. I thought it was wrong. People came to me and were like, well, how come you're not defending, you know, Jeffrey Lord, who was a CNN guy at the time, who was, I don't know, making Nazi comments. And I'm like, because I don't think his comment was equivalent to mine. Like, there can be a class of things that people can make a determination about, and there can be a difference within that class of language. It's not, I don't feel that people should be fired for language one way or another, or they should be banned for language one way or another. It's a function of the instance and the language in and of itself. And in this instance, there is a big difference between the N-word and the cracker word, as it were, because, like, yeah, you say, of the history and the meaning behind, that's what meaning of words means. It doesn't just mean what it, there's context to it. And, you know, anybody who could read my tweet understood the context in that joke. I wasn't actually saying that I get to choose who rapes my daughter. I was making a satirical point about people trying to apologize essentially for a rapist. And
yeah, yeah.
There's context. And, you know, I think Twitch has the ability and YouTube has the ability to decide what their terms of service are. But you can also sort of say, like, they're wrong on certain issues. And they're wrong in this case, as far as I can tell.
And by the way, for the record, I've long been an advocate for the Twitch terms of service. As a matter of fact, it's something that I believe is the reason why that platform is overall a lot better and a lot safer for content creators, even though there are hate raids and whatnot that goes on. And I've said this even though I've gotten, you know, unfairly banned numerous times. Like, for example, when I showed, like, gore, they considered it to be gore because I was showing Michael Moore's, like, a Bowling for Columbine documentary. When I was describing American imperialism and, you know, all of the war crimes in America engaged in Latin American countries. So, despite the fact that I've been on the receiving end of many bans, some worthy, some understandable, Dan Crenshaw, some not so understandable, like the thing I just mentioned, or cracker, I think that their rigorous application of the terms of service in comparison to other platforms, of course, that's not still not like perfect, very difficult job, is the reason why there's a lot less hate speech that goes on Twitch than other platforms and other comparable platforms, like even YouTube, as a matter of fact. YouTube is working on it too, don't get me wrong, but for the past 10 years when I was working at the Young Turks, and even now, my number one issue with YouTube has always been white supremacist radicalization on the platform and how much white supremacists and Nazis can literally use the platform itself. Twitch, not so much, because they do ban you, but they go too far. I do still prefer it, though.
Yeah, and I think, like, you know, they can make a these are situations where I think they could revisit and sort of get a better and more sophisticated understanding of what's going on. I mean, it's not like these are, you know, it's not like bots, right? I mean, these are human beings making these decisions, and human brains have a certain nimbleness that an algorithm theoretically does not have, and a human brain can say, the term cracker just does not mean and have the same implications as the N-word in this country, even though they are both, you know, racial insults or slurs. And I would think that someone would have the, you know, the nimbleness of mind to make that distinction. But,
I agree. The problem is that there is a lot of outrage that you can almost mathematically create on the internet, right? This is the age-old argument. This is something that people on the internet that love doing debates, a lot of the people that call into your show and say, Sam, I don't know, I'm a libertarian, like, those are the same dudes who, on the one hand, love arguing about being able to say the N-word as a white guy, and then on the other hand, love talking about white fragility and how white people are actually oppressed. And white people are oppressed, just not on the virtue of being white. There's right. No historical oppression or contemporary oppression attached to being white. That doesn't mean you're not oppressed if you're not, you know, if you're gay, if you are, you know, a member of the LGBT community. You can be marginalized in different ways as a white man, right? But, and most importantly and most significantly, in my opinion, on the virtue of your class, if you're poor, if you were born into a poorer family, if you're destined to be a worker for the rest of your life, then yes, you are going to experience a fuckload of alienation, a fuckload of oppression. But that's not because you're white. And I stress that regularly, but that's a really difficult concept for people who have, you know, who've grown up with liberal politics to comprehend. And unfortunately, oppressors and people who are in the dominant group regularly will use these sorts of liberal institutions and their liberal understandings of certain concepts to, you know, get their way. They can say, cracker really offends me, I'm a white guy, and then actually get their way while simultaneously laughing about it and saying the N-word, even when they're, you know, attacking people for saying the word cracker.
What is your overall perspective on this idea of you know, the deplatforming and that type of stuff, just generally? I'm curious as to that, because that has been like an ongoing debate that we've had on this program, I think, for years, the idea of like nationalizing these platforms. I mean, in my opinion, we should be breaking up these tech monopolies so that the implications of getting deplatformed from any given one are not so huge.
So we're fully in agreement that, you know, destroying these tech monopolies is the best possible way to go. I hate the monopolization of every sector of the American economy. Shouts out to Ronald Reagan. But as far as deplatforming, I do think it's a very successful method of stopping harmful ideas from spreading. I understand that, you know, when we start talking about like who gets to make that decision, and that's terrible. Yeah, these platforms demonstrably make bad decisions on a regular basis on these issues. So I guess you're right. Breaking up these tech monopolies would at the very least, like, kind of divvy up that power a little bit, so you could go somewhere else and you're not just like relegated to BitChute or something, even though those are usually the Nazis and shit that go there. But no, deplatforming, I think, can be completely understandable, completely reasonable, and successful. Radicalization is a real thing. Stochastic terror is a real thing. These are real concepts. Is the FBI using like a loose terminology for it, or are they actually actively pursuing like some, you know, people that they declare white supremacists? Certainly. Will it ever turn into, you know, the post-Patriot Act world in which like how Muslims were targeted? Most likely not. Spencer Ackerman talks about this extensively in Reign of Terror. So I think deplatforming works, and it can be viable, and it can be appropriate. And most people, unless they have like a Noam Chomsky style approach, or I guess Glenn Greenwald is, can't really consider him to be principled anymore, but like a Noam Chomsky style approach, if you're a free speech absolutist, that's one thing. But the overwhelming majority of people understand that, you know, there are boundaries to free speech. There are boundaries to free speech in the sense that even in America, which has the most liberal free speech rules, right? There are still boundaries on what you can and can't say. And I think those boundaries are appropriate for society to function. And I think hate speech should be part of those boundaries. Absolutely.
And we should say, I mean, I think I don't know that. And maybe again with Chomsky, it may be different. But the absolutists, when it comes to free speech, I don't think would be in favor. I mean, certainly not Glenn, with his libertarian leanings, would be happy with the government essentially regulating that these private corporations should allow for no terms of service. I mean, starts getting
that has never happened, and that will never happen.
Of course,
when you have no terms of service, you turn into Gab or you turn into Parler, which ironically still do have a terms of service, and also those platforms become hotbeds for pedophiles, Nazis, and in a lot of instances, pedophile Nazis. So that's, you know, and also liberals don't want to frequent those platforms. So even Republicans and conservatives that want to own the libs don't like going to those platforms anymore, because then there's no libs to own there.
Exactly.
Just a bunch of pedophile Nazis talking to one another about the white race. And that gets really boring after a while, right? You have to be really invested in racism to enjoy those platforms.
That shows how people are the problem with free speech, right? Like, no, that thing about like nobody wants to go to Gab because like it's all Nazis. Like, no normal person would go there. Like, we think about going there just for like the confrontation, maybe.
Right.
But like, yeah. They're not. They aren't compatible for free speech, no matter how much they cry about how much they're the real defenders of it, while they like are happy when you get banned from Twitch, for instance.
Well, one of the problems is there is no innovation in the white supremacy sector these days. They are not coming up with new theories. It is just they just keep playing the hits over and over again. There is just no.
Why fix it if it ain't broke, Sam?
Exactly. Well, all right. So let's. I mean, I don't know. I mean, if there's you know, you're going to be back on Twitch in what, like a couple of days? How many days do they give you a timeout for?
Seven.
7 days. That's how long.
Which is like a lot longer than like most bans. It's like the second law. I mean, there's perma, there's a 30-day ban, and then there's a 7-day ban. But most bans are usually around like a 1-day or 3-day bans. You can appeal it, but I don't think they're going to allow me to.
Yeah, 3-day ban. I'm just curious as to like the cracker infringement. And of course, when I say cracker, I'm talking about crackers. But
yeah,
the
of course.
Crackers infringement. Where does that, like, what would you do to get a 2-day ban on Twitch? And what would you do to get a 30-day ban? I'm just curious as to where that falls in the spectrum.
Well, I can't say, because this is a part of the process that they basically keep a complete secret. I don't know who any of the moderators on that team specifically are. We never know. People at Twitch that work within the company, I think, in some instances, don't even know. So it's like a group of people that, you know, are basically the gatekeepers, and usually they do a pretty good job. Like, don't get me wrong, I am understanding of what they have to do. I do think that the cracker discourse is a unique one, because it's one that you can very easily use against liberals, right? especially, this is like BDS, right? Like people love white supremacists and people who are engaging in white identity politics, whether they are white supremacists themselves or not, regularly utilize marginalized groups and their rhetoric effectively to dominate the conversation and to create oppression for themselves, to create a victimhood narrative for themselves. That's why you got the All Lives Matter to the Black Lives Matter. That's why, you know, you have the pro-lifers to the pro-choicers, right? Like, they're not saying we're pro-forcing your pregnancy to term. They're saying they're pro-life. That's why you have Blue Lives Matter. So they're very effective at using liberal academic language in a cynical capacity to kind of win over liberals in the margins who may or may not have been, I don't know, captivated by, or at the very least, like, nurtured into believing certain white supremacist values growing up in a country like America. America is very racist, and all of our institutions churn out that information, whether it is white supremacists through omission, like not educating people on certain concepts, or overtly white supremacists by saying stuff like, you know, the Civil War was the war of Northern aggression. You know, these are all very profoundly important ways in which people are educated to recognize white plight and white oppression as a unique struggle, whether they recognize it or not. And this impacts not just white people, but even black people, even, you know, black and brown people that grow up within this education system are going to sympathize with some of these values because it's the dominant attitude.
I mean, I think to some extent that's what's going on with this, you know, anti-CRT in the classrooms thing. I mean, and it's starting to, it's an attempt to sort of, create this notion that white people are being victimized, by both mischaracterizing critical race theory and lying about where it's being taught, for that matter. Frankly, I would like to see it. In the, you know, I think you could probably develop a program that would be appropriate for elementary school kids. It would be important. It's interesting, too. I think that there is what's fascinating is that you're starting to see now, coming out of this anti-CRT stuff, I think it was something in the American Conservative I read that was essentially trying to reestablish the Dunning School, which is the sort of prevalent historical interpretation of Reconstruction, trying to reassert that, because they're now claiming that that it is wrong to reprint, I think, Du Bois' Reconstruction, the book. They're complaining about this now. I mean, this is where it's traveling to, right? Like
it's always going to expand because there's no, it's never going to end with Cracker. It's a ridiculous take regardless. It will, as long as you continue recognizing this as like a unique form of oppression, and that's very real, as long as you make, you know, white identitarians feel valid about their plight, even if they are totally antagonizing and totally creating a false victimhood narrative deliberately and cynically, they will continue to make gains, and you see it. Like, that's how we got to Charlottesville. Like, you give them an inch and they, you know, they take a mile. Ultimately, I suspect, like, you know, calling someone a Nazi, for example, you could totally make the argument that this is a racially charged term. I mean, this is, most of the time, it's being used towards white people. It's, I think it's oppressive. I wasn't a part of the, you know, Nazi party in 1938. That's ridiculous that you're calling me, a white person, a Nazi. I think you should be banned for it. You know, this is, there's the endless opportunity there.
And again, the issue is just sort of, you know, context matters. The most weaponized I remember a Cracker ever being used in my lifetime was on episodes of, I think, the Jeffersons, against the neighbors who would come by. But they were all actors, and it was a sitcom, and they were all paid, and it was just written in the dialogue.
Yeah, I mean, I personally have never met, and I myself have been called Cracker many times, going after like different fandoms. You know, shouts out to the Barbs out there if you're watching, Sam. I've been called a Cracker many times. Many, many times. Definitely more times than most of the people crying about being called a cracker on the internet. Doesn't matter. It's a ridiculous thing. It's not dehumanizing. It's not. It's not associated with any sort of like serious oppression.
All right. Well, I mean, I think. If we've covered all that, I'm curious on your perspective on some other things that are going on in the news today.
There's a segue there that, you know, we can engage in. Apparently, the libertarian brain that defends Project Veritas doesn't actually end up defending a white guy getting banned for saying cracker. Glenn Greenwald came out with
Not seen the tweet where he is defending you against Twitch on this. Has he?
No, he did not. He said, "What goes around comes around."
That's all this has been setting up for. My opinion is coming when the eventual purge comes. That's what I think.
That's like the functional equivalent of cheering on, you know, saying that unvaccinated should not go to the hospitals, right? I mean, like his whole brand has been an unwavering principled stance, regardless of who the players are.
Maybe. I mean, I don't know if Greenwald, but that principle was a bit shaky around the Nathan Robinson Guardian thing too, among some other of those Substackers, like taking a little bit of victory laps or a little bit gleeful at a leftist getting banned.
Well, all right, let's.
The thing about that is like Glenn is ridiculous in this issue because like. He knows for a fucking fact that I have been a massive advocate for, you know, BDS protesters and how much of a disgusting erosion of the First Amendment laws that we supposedly have in this country whenever, you know, you have to sign like that you've never, you have to sign like loyalty to the state of Israel and that you've never actually said Palestinians are human to be a fucking teacher in Texas. Like, I think that's insane. And that is a true restriction of freedom of speech.
I just want to be clear so that people understand what you're talking about. There are, I think, something like 20 states in the country, maybe there's more, where to get a contract from the state, whether you're a speech therapist helping kids in public school or whether you're, I don't know, supplying, toilet paper for the state house bathrooms, you need to sign a pledge to say that you will not engage in the constitutionally protected right to protest or boycott Israeli products. There are 20 some odd states that make you sign this. The Republicans tried to push this on a federal level. I think it was Marco Rubio a couple of years ago brought it up in the Senate. Yeah, it's obscene. It's absolutely obscene. And that is genuine First Amendment stuff because, of course, we're talking about the government. So I just wanted to, if people weren't aware of that.
Yeah, he basically said that, Glenn basically said, you know, pro-censorship, like liberals being pro-censorship will lead to this. And he basically said banning people for the, not basically, I'm reading his tweet. Banning people for using the term cracker is obviously demented and repressive, but the ultimate case for reaping and sowing. It is incredibly easy to predict, and many tried warning that banning people like Milo and Alex Jones would inevitably lead to this outcome. So this idea that, like, people are getting banned for saying cracker was inevitably going to happen is a silly one, considering that, like, platforms were incredibly strict on anything that goes outside of like the liberal to reactionary, neat little ideological box of conformity for a very long time. You never were able to, you know, you would get clapped as a defender of Palestine regularly, even before Alex Jones and Milo was eased off the platform.
I mean, you know, yeah. Never mind, but I mean, and we should say that, 30 years ago, 25 years ago, maybe it was about 30. Barry Crimmins was in front of Congress. The late Barry Crimmins was testifying about pedophiles on AOL. When that was Well, and that was a platform, and they had chat rooms, and they were allowing child predators on there, and it got shut down. And you wouldn't hear any arguments at that time, like this is a slippery slope. The fact of the matter is that there people can make a difference between peddling one type of stuff versus another. And that those type of assessments are made all the time. And there's inevitably going to be mistakes, like I think Twitch made in your case. And that's part of the process. And that's part of like the way that these things develop. And the idea that they're all the same because you're deplatforming a person. And so it's necessarily all the same case is childish. And it really is less, and I think it's indicative of just his response to you, frankly, it is less about a principled stance and more about, like, this is just the methodology he's using to advocate for a certain ideology that he obscures. And, yeah. I mean...
I wonder if he thinks that McCarthyism is a product of, you know, liberal identity politics as well. Maybe that's why it happened. Yeah, Red Scare happened only because, you know, the left wanted too much censorship.
Of course. I mean, he will use it. I mean, and you know, it's been the this is his methodology, and I think it's quite clear. And I will say this, though. We're getting a lot of complaints about your fingernail polish. And I think it was very big of us to allow you on.
Thank you. Despite me being weird. It's a weird guy.
A lot of people in the office totally freaked out right now. And that was really funny. And I have to say also, I mean, I didn't actually think that we would go into this, but I guess we both couldn't help ourselves. The fact that he took offense that you were saying that that he and Jimmy are old. And I will say this. Glenn is, as far as I know, probably about 6 months younger than I. And maybe less, maybe 4 or 5. I think he's maybe not quite hit 55 yet. We are old. I want to make that clear. We're old. 55 is old.
You're a fox, Sam. You know that.
Well, that may or may not be the case. And Glenn is a strapping young-looking fellow. Not young, but old fellow as well. And Jimmy, you know. But we're old. You're young. That's just a fact. And I think, you know, it's important for us to sort of just accept it. And it's not pejorative. It just happens to be that, like, when you get to be our age, you just certain things look like you're on our lawn, and it's upsetting to us. But that's, you know,
it doesn't matter how old you are. If you start freaking out on someone because they have because a straight dude, straight male has like painted their nails a color, then that's like boomer behavior. Boomerism is a mindset. And
those commercials. And like the couple is in like the Home Depot or whatever, and the guy with blue hair, and he's like, you don't have to say anything about the blue hair, and the dad can't help himself. That's the same behavior.
It's pretty shocking. I mean, like it's not, I gotta say, and I'm not a boomer. I don't think, Glenn couldn't be because he is like 5 or 6 months younger than me. But, you know, even boomers, we've had plenty of people in our generation, in Gen X, who wear nail polish. It just seems like, I mean, like a very odd thing to fixate on. But I guess that was what the reach is. Who do you think they're all now? I mean, do you think they just like basically are in competition with Steven Crowder in terms of their audience?
I think that there's a lot of... Look, there's a big audience in independent media always that is constantly looking for reactionary content and people to tell them that they agree with them. It's, I think, even better if this is supposedly like a leftist person or a left adjacent person telling a reactionary person that they agree with them. Like, everyone wants to be comforted for their points of view. So, it's certainly... it's certainly a viable way to make money. I think that's, I think it's an immoral way to do so, but that's probably what they're cashing in on. I mean, a lot of these guys, they get fat Substacks, you know, decent amount of money. I know Glenn loves talking about how much money I make whenever that comes up, but like, I'm one person. Like, we don't have a lot of incredibly successful leftist media operations that are independent, you know?
We
don't even have a lot of leftist media operations in general in comparison to how broad the spectrum of like reactionary content that is readily available on YouTube that is sometimes independent and other times actually backed by the very same institutions, entities, human beings that would back mainstream media outlets that churn that kind of misinformation.
It's pretty stunning what you're talking. I mean, like, we will every now and then hear about somebody that we've never heard about. The last one was this guy, J.P. Sears. I just had a thing. Have you ever heard of J.P. Sears?
No.
He is a conservative, anti-vaccine comic who gets like 2 million views per video he puts out about this, you know, with anti-vax conservative talking points.
Oh, I know. That dude looks hurt. Yo, that dude, oh my God, he looks like such a fucking, that dude is the archetypical Los Angeles failed actor who absolutely fucking was like, oh, there's a target rich environment of suckers here that'll like watch anything I say as long as they agree with me. And like, it's such bottom of the barrel commentary. It's just like, liberals are so stupid. It's like the, what's that fucking SNL guy that was on with Dave Chappelle in that movie, Jim Brewer or whatever? Like, it's his style of comedy where he's like, liberals are like this. And then everyone's like, yes, I agree with that. Thank you. Thank you so much. It's just, you know, it's the reactionary version of Nanette. And it sucks.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my point was that there's a ton of these guys out there. Now, we here are swimming in, drowning in Google money, as most people know, completely drowning in it. But for the most part, there's really a very limited number of people who do this on the left and can actually make a living at it. I was fortunate enough to come off of Air America, and I had an email list, and that was basically the only thing that basically saved me 10, 11 years ago. But for the most part, very difficult to build an audience on the left, whether it's you're talking about liberals or you're talking about progressives or socialists. It's tough. It happens, but it's tough. And on the right, there's just a lot more money, and there's a lot more, frankly, you know, funding that comes from places like the Koch brothers. Maybe it gets laundered a couple of times through different organizations, and but there's a lot of money out there. There's a lot of lost leader attitude on the right that doesn't exist on the left, obviously, because, you know.
Yeah, I don't know why someone who has been a beneficiary of wealth hoarding or the centralization of wealth would turn around and pay for someone to tell them like that's wrong, that entire system that allowed them to make billions of dollars and accumulate that kind of wealth, is that system needs to be dismantled. They're not going to do that. People who benefit from that are not going to turn around and pay for people to advocate against that.
Even on Air America, the big money was afraid of giving money to Air America and supporting it, investing in it, because the big money, the liberal, you know, center to the left money, is afraid of populism, because the populism on the left is economic populism. The folks like the Koch brothers, or the countless number of billionaires, frankly, that fund these things. Every day you hear about another person who's like $300 million for, you know, to invest in some type of seed thing for online right-wing content. They're not afraid of the right-wing populism because it doesn't threaten their dollars at the end of the day.
They don't criticize venture capitalism.
No. And even when you look at like what, you know, the critique that Glenn has of big tech, he will pay some lip service to the idea of dismembering it, but it really becomes which flavor of big tech is evil, right? Google is evil. PayPal's not necessarily evil. Facebook's not necessarily evil. I mean, even in what's also fascinating to me is, like, you know, I remember interviewing him about his book about the Manichaean style of the Bush administration. Good, evil, how childish he thought that was at the time. But now it's effective because it's really deployed as a way of building a brand and these subsidiary brands, whether it's Substack or Rumble or whatever, Colin or whatever it is. And instead of saying there's a structural problem here that needs to be dealt with, and this is the point. It's not that Google is evil or Facebook is evil. It is these, anything of this size, any enterprise of this size is bad for society. It's not like these specific, you know, individuals there are evil. Maybe they are, but that's irrelevant. It is the structure of these things that needs to be dealt with.
Absolutely. Just like the systemic problems will still persist. And there is a big difference that I always like to point to when we're looking at cultural hegemony, right? Bad behavior and like policing what you would consider to be like bad thoughts and bad attitudes in liberal media is something that a lot of liberals also like to engage in, rad libs. And I criticize that too, to a certain degree, when people are just like, why is there a bad character doing bad things in this movie? That's bullshit. They should always do, you know, human beings should not be complex. They should be arbiters of morality and yada yada. And I think that's a silly way. And I think that that's bad for art overall. And I don't like that. And I personally don't even think that these cultural movements actually end up pushing for systemic change. I will admit that. Okay. They're the only time, however, though, that any sort of cultural artifact, a movie, for example, like Birth of a Nation, can push for some kind of attitude shift is if the material realities already support that. America was already a deeply white supremacist nation. We already have a lot of white supremacist institutions. And then Birth of a Nation happens. That's how you start, forming an active base for the Klan, right? That can't happen with the opposite. You can't combat material realities and material inequalities by making people watch a movie and then, you know, feel a certain type of way. You can only do that if you are already in the dominant group and that your ideology is baked into all of the institutions and your attitude is reflected in like everyday lives, in our everyday lives, even if people don't recognize it's happening.
So
that's how nefarious it is.
You're saying that these cultural forces can be accelerants, but they cannot be, they can't flip, be catalysts and flip.
Yes. Yes.
I think that's true.
The revolutionary spark can only happen if there is a base of support within the material inequalities and that there is like already organizing occurring alongside that. It can't do it on its own. No one's going to watch a movie and be like, all right, I'm fucking Marxist now. And like, you know, and then enough people watch it and then they all become, Marxists. And then that's how you form the Vanguard Party. Like, that's not how it happens. It happens at workplaces. It happens through organizing.
And I think that that limitation is true for the type of stuff that we do, frankly, as well. Like there has been, because, you know, of the nature of, I think, the people who do this kind of stuff that we do and the economic incentives to sort of inflate our influence in this sphere. I mean, I think you have a much bigger audience, obviously, than we do here. But even there, it is you can influence ideas. But I think ultimately we're not catalysts for broad based change. That has to happen with people in their their real life relationships and interactions and workplace and their relationship to their own work. The idea that people are like, we don't have a certain policy because these five YouTubers are not behind it is, I think, a little bit problematic in terms of people's understanding of how this stuff works.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's funny to me whenever people greatly exaggerate, like, the influence that I have, even when they're like, oh, you're going to get the Democratic Party to not vote for Joe Biden if you keep criticizing him. And I'm like, if I could get people to vote a certain way, Bernie Sanders would be fucking the president. You know, he would have won the primaries. Like, it's not my influence is nothing in comparison to the trillions of dollars of earned media that mainstream media outlets can offer a particular candidate if they want to shift their weight towards them. You know, I don't just mean paid media. I don't mean, you know, I'm using the technical definition here. Earned media is when someone talks about your candidate, for those of you who don't know, in an organic capacity, like, oh yeah, look how crazy it is that Joe Biden won Super Tuesday. That's wild. Like, or leading up to Super Tuesday, talking about how great Joe Biden is. Like, that's earned media versus paid media would be buying ads. It works side by side, but earned media is incredibly powerful.
Yeah, I think the dynamic is very similar to what you were talking about, just, you know, in terms of where the culture is. We can be accelerants. We can be the reinforcers. We can help a little bit, but it's not happening with any given or even a multitude of YouTubers. It's all just butterfly wings type of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, that doesn't mean that, like, what we're doing is not significant. Don't get me wrong. I think you guys are doing a great job. And I think, like, trying to break away from the capitalist dogma or even, like, the center-right liberal attitude that Americans have on most economic issues, I think that's really good. But it can't be done individually by YouTubers and Twitch streamers and podcasters. It has to be also accompanied with, like, on-the-ground organizing.
And stuff like, you know, Matt was just saying, you know, defense against, like, stuff like Project Veritas. I mean, I think we're most effective when we're just talking about media narratives and where they start. I mean, that's the interesting thing, I think, about Twitter on some level, too, is that much of what's happening on Twitter is really a function of influencing the sense of reporters who are on Twitter as to what's going on in the narrative. I mean, that's the sort of interesting dynamic. You're almost like taking advantage of the myopia that most human beings have, which is like, oh, I heard a lot on Twitter. It must be going on out there. And then you have people who actually have the ability to write, like in the New York Times, and have a sense of what's happening. That very often cuts the other way because it's all about, you know, somebody at Kenyon College said you can't say this word. And so that's our biggest problem in this country or something to that effect. But
yeah, I hate that. I absolutely hate it because it's like this idea that so many people who fancy themselves to be like, you know, white working class whisperers exclusively hyper-focus on the exact same kind of culture war bullshit that like reactionary outlets focus on, like Fox News, and think that that is the end all be all when it's like a dude living in Western Pennsylvania, his life is not going to change if like a couple students who were maybe even a little, you know, heated, maybe a little over the top, and were yelling at a professor. You know what I mean? Like, that's not changing anybody's life. It's just simply a distraction. And they're doing it deliberately. They're distracting you from the main problems. They're distracting you from the reality that the Joe Biden administration hasn't done shit. But even Republicans aren't doing a better job of criticizing the Joe Biden administration. They're still hyper-focusing on made-up narratives like CRT. And all this other shit. Why? Because if they were to hold Joe Biden to account, if they truly were economic populists like, you know, Donald Trump presented himself to be, but he wasn't actually, right? They would be hammering Joe Biden on student loan debt relief. Where is it?
Of course.
Where is the student loan debt relief? they would be even talking more about how Joe Biden is currently utilizing Title 42 and trying to keep Title 42 in action to ensure that, you know, asylum seekers who are legally and morally, by the way, seeking asylum within our borders, purging them from the country by using the Donald Trump era CDC restrictions and using this like COVID restrictions to purge them from the country without giving them their right to seek asylum. That's disgusting.
Same dynamic with Remain in Mexico. You had a court order that they needed to come to a deal with Mexico, but the idea that deals can be sewn up so quickly, it seems fascinating to me. I mean, I don't know. I will say this, and this actually raises something I was going to talk about today. I didn't get to yet, but there was the Biden administration. You know, they just held one of the biggest sales for auctions for oil and gas drilling leases in the Gulf of Mexico's history. And I think it was in November. And it happened literally just days after COP26.
Because they listen to the scientists, Sam. That's how it works.
And the at the time, the administration said that we were compelled to by a court ruling that was in favor of a bunch of Republican-led states that sued to lift the blanket pause that the administration had put on the drilling permits. But apparently, this according to The Guardian, the DOJ, just before the lease, acknowledged that the judgment does not force the government to auction off the drilling rights in the Gulf. I'm not going to, you know, I don't need to read what the DOJ says. That was just what it said. Now, here's the question I have. I wonder, and I'm looking at this, there's also a big fight at the FDIC right now, which, the long story short, there's a Republican, Trump-appointed chair of the FDIC, and there's a majority on the board of Democrats, and they're having a big sort of like bureaucratic fight because the Democrats want to regulate the banks harder and want to prevent consolidation. There is the Biden administration that deserves
communism.
Credit, deserves credit for not quite communism, but for antitrust. They're pretty good on it in terms of the administration, in terms of the personnel. That story has sort of broken out into the open because it's pretty high profile. I wonder, when I see stuff like this, whether the Department of the Interior is still staffed by a lot of Trump appointed people who, when there's a court order, instead of dragging their feet, race to fulfill this thing before there's, like, you know, because this is a massive, our government has tens of thousands of people who come in with a new administration, or they don't. And we're still a year out dealing with a lot of these agencies that are Trump staffed. And the Biden administration just doesn't have it's just the sheer, you know, it's a difficult operation. I've been trying to get, you know, frickin' pullover hoodies on our merch site for 7 months, and it takes me time to do it. I don't know the answer to this, but
Republicans want it more. And also, not only that, but also they don't go against the interest, material interest of their benefactors, their corporate benefactors and their wealthy benefactors. Like, that's the reality. Whereas Democrats, Democrats campaign on systemic problems that they are seeking to solve that are diametrically opposed to the material interests of their benefactors, which is precisely why they have to be the party of incompetence, whereas Republicans can be the party of viciousness and immorality and openly engage in like racial agitative propaganda, white anxieties. You know, use that as a really effective deflection away from the real problems that the American working class is facing. Whereas Democrats just look like incompetent fools that can only focus on you know, making sure your favorite TV show doesn't have any like hateful sentiment expressed in it, even if it's simply for parody. And I think that that is just a really silly, self-defeating way of running. And let alone the reality that Democrats only run every 4 years or every 2 years when they remember that they're, you know, they need to win seats versus Republicans are running all the time because they have to activate certain key bases within their movement and are consistently hammering on their narratives. Otherwise, how the hell are you going to get a bunch of random people to advocate for tort reform? You know what I mean? Or even school choice. Like these are ideas that they add on to other pre-existing movements that are organically growing, like QAnon. That's why when you see like a QAnon rally, you got like a Republican council member running for a fucking district in like Southern California, literally talking about school choice. But you're at a QAnon rally. And it's like, yeah, you know, Democrats are pedophiles. Also, we should give more vouchers. You know, we should allocate some of this communist public schooling system funds away from these, you know, horrible communist teachers and give them to private schools, religious schools. It's like, well, you just bake that in there so perfectly. And they do this year round. They do this nonstop because they want it more. And also because that's what the benefactors want. And that's what the benefactors want, even if they're actually, you know, giving money to the Democratic Party.
And I do think, you know, there's just a lot less friction between school choice and QAnon than there is between, you know, funding public schools more and wealthy benefactors. I mean, that's just the bottom line. There's just it's not as steep of a hill, I guess. All right, ma'am. Well, listen, I guess enjoy your vacation.
Yeah, I mean, I'm gonna keep making content. Like, they're not gonna. It's really annoying because the ban is like really rigorous. Really, like, you can't appear on anyone else's streams. You can't like basically limit you from hanging out with your friends and your coworkers, which is understandable.
Are you not allowed to see family members?
No, I can see my family members. Yeah, my mom and dad are here right now. They're staying with me. But, you know, I'm still going to keep trucking away.
Over when they heard about the ban?
No, they loved it. They were like, oh, great. Like, then we will be able to go and vacation. I was like, absolutely not.
All right. Well, hang in there. Thanks for coming on. It was good to.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
All right. We'll talk to you later. There it is, ladies and gentlemen. Our first crack and cheese and crackers segment that we've had on this show.
Probably the last.
Maybe the last. I don't know. These are pretty tasty. Folks, that's all the time we have today. Do we have an update on Emma's COVID test?
Negative. She's negative. She's waiting to hear back on her friend, but
she's not coming back. All right. That's pretty convenient.
She timed that well.
I cannot wait until we get the call from Matt tomorrow. I think I better go get tested, but there's a huge line.
I'm not going to blow one of those days on a Wednesday. I got to do the stream on Wednesday.
Oh, yeah, there you go. He shows up on his own show. Why?
Feeling better.
Folks, just a reminder, it's your support that makes the show possible. You can become a member. Join themajorityreport.com. And listen, if you're in Boston and you want to see us live, majoritylive.com. We are going to Boston to celebrate the anniversary of January 16th. Holding it on January 16th. We call it the Big Live show that we're going to see. We'll be there in Boston. Larry Murphy, John Benjamin, both of Bob's Burgers. John Benjamin also of that. What's that show? Archer. Never seen it. Natalie Scherr will be with us. We may have some more guests in Boston. January 16th, Sunday, 3 p.m. 3 p.m. at the Wilbur Theater. Go to Majority Live and check it out. We will all be there. Masked, vaxxed, at least for the audience. We will all take tests before we get onto that stage. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian media universe?
Oh, yeah. Last night I talked with Gregory from Oklahoma for about an hour and a half. About a lot about myself, honestly. So that will be out on the Green Corn Rebellion show. And then on Left Reckoning tomorrow, Wednesday, Liza Featherstone, we're talking about the crisis of masculinity and how we can address it in a way that's not really cringeworthy. So 8 Eastern, patreon.com/Left Reckoning to get the post game.
I want to see that, Greg from Oklahoma. I want to hear more about you.
That's the place for it. Go into my high school and college and all that stuff.
And the Liza Featherstone thing sounds pretty awesome too, actually. Folks, we're going to head into our fun half, wherein we take your phone calls at 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. And we also, what we do is we take IMs. And the way you IM the show is you get the free app at majorityapp.com. And then you can IM the show, and then I read your IM. And that's what we do around these parts. See you in the fun half.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.